Hello there. This is Robert Itis for Plants and Their Friends.
Hi, this is Sina Kasem for Plants and Their Friends.
And today we're going to talk about two topics. The first is compost, and the second is harvesting rainwater. We're going to need to figure out when we're about halfway through it. So let me start with composting, and then I'm going to have Sina jump in because she's had some experiences that she would like to share. I have been a guerrilla composter for many years. What does that mean? Well, it means that you come along with a vehicle, and when people rake up their leaves and pile them in bags on the area between the sidewalk and the curb, which is a no man's land, you come by and you pick up those bags of leaves. And you make your compost. One of the main ingredients for compost is leaves. And leaves are over the majority of what you put into your compost bins. So to go around in the fall and get bags of leaves from preferably lawns that look like they're organic, or places that look like there's not that many plastic things hanging around, you can get some inexpensive compost. Now, where are you going to put it? Some of the easiest and cheapest is to get some pallets and get some cheesecloth or screening, and put the screening down so it goes past the pallets, and then put all of the pallets together and strap them in. Obviously, two sides have to be exactly the same. Other than that, it could be square, it could be rectilinear. And then you just start throwing things into that compost bin. Mostly grass and leaf cuttings, and some vegetable compost, especially when you're harvesting and there's stuff left over that you want to do. There are some plants that are excellent for compost, and we'll probably get into that pretty soon. The idea is you have two types of compost bins. One is a compost bin where you layer it and you just keep putting stuff on it. Another is one where you turn it, or you pitchfork turning it. And a third would be adding water at certain times. Most of the time the rains do what you need to do with the open compost bin. With a closed compost bin that's a tumbler or something like that, it's a little bit more difficult. Sometimes you do need to add some things. And you'll know when it's done by the dark, well-granulated soil that it creates. And that's the stuff that you want to put in your gardens and in your forest. All amended soil should be fully composted, in my estimation. Now, there's a woman that I met early on, Dr. Elaine Ingham from, at that time, Oregon State. And she has a website, soilfoodsweb.com. and she measures compost. However, if you don't want to, and it's pretty expensive, if you don't want to get your soil measured for composting, then the formula that she has given of, for forest soil, 75% fungal material, barks and leaves, down to that black granule, and manures. Manures that are fully composted. And you take 75% for your forest soil, 75% of your fungal mixture with 25% of your bacterial mixture. And your soil will come out about pH 5.6 to 6.0. And then if you take it and you put 75% bacteria or manure and 25% fungal, you'll have a kind of soil that is good for vegetable growing. Again, they both have to be totally, fully composted. Now, bacteria occurs when there's poop, and when the grass or food goes through the stomach of the animal, including worms, there's bacteria that is given off, and it's the bacteria and the fungal matter mixed together at a certain range that can be good for amended soils. I am not as much of a advocate of getting soil tests, and the only thing that they're going to tell you is which chemical to throw on it. If you don't deplete your soil and you build it up, then there's no need to add some of these chemicals which you're maintaining in the soil. So one of the things that permaculture talks about is no-till farming. That you create your beds kind of like lasagna, where there's different layers of straw and newspaper and cardboard and plants and more straw. And you know, this is a good recipe, and you don't have to till the soil. If you till the soil, you're going to need nitrogen. If you break open the soil, you're going to have to add nitrogen. So the no-till, we feel, is a lot better. And when you think about it, when you till that soil, there are microorganisms down in there that you've now broken up that community. And you're not going to have them helping your plants as much. You're going to have to add chemicals in there to do their job. So maintain the micro communities that you have, and build up your beds so that there are a built-up of composted material to make your beds sustainable. I'm going to take a break now and turn it over to Sina to talk about some of the books she's brought in.
Thank you, Robert. I'm glad you brought up Elaine Ingram. She is absolutely amazing, and her website has a couple of free courses on soils as well as composting, and absolutely just a wealth of information. I really love composting. It's absolutely amazing. I've done the gorilla composting as well, where you pick up leaves and you can make some incredible compost as far as the base of your compost. You basically want... you do want a ratio of some carbons to some nitrogens to keep it in balance. And there's different kinds of composting. There's hot composting and cold composting. And the cold composting is more of where you make Robert was speaking about sheet mulching and lasagna bed preparation. you can make layers of different organic matters of your leaves, your wood chips, and possibly some produce scraps and lawn clippings, and then just leave it to compost there for, you know, 6 months, maybe 10 months, depending on how thick the layers are, and it'll turn into really rich, nutrient-dense compost. Or there's the hot composting where it's churned. And then there's also smaller scale composting. Vermiculture is one I'm really, really fond of. And then there is also bokashi. With bokashi compost, it's more of a fermentation, but you're able to compost things in there like meats, dairies, and cheeses. And those things are generally not recommended in an outdoor composting pile because those can attract critters. One of my absolute favorite books is Worms Eat My Garbage by Mary Eppelhoff. And this book really changed my life, it did. I ended up starting a vermicomposting business because the worms are just absolutely amazing. 1 pound of worms will eat 1/2 pound of compost or scraps a day. And so that is a huge amount. So once you got a worm bin up and going, you could harvest compost, you know, every day. And some of the larger bins that we had, we were harvesting 30, 40 pounds of vermicompost every couple of days. So you can really do a lot with that. And the thing that's unique about worm compost is that really any compost, you really do want to feed the soil first. And by doing that, the plants become more resilient to things like aphids. They become more resilient to drought and other pest infestations. The Rose Society out west was a real big proponent of using vermicompost because their show roses had less aphids when they were using vermicompost during January and February out there to feed their roses before the spring growth. And if you chop things up in your compost bin, like when you go to feed either worms or composting, by increasing the surface area, chopping things up, they'll break down faster for you. You did mention about organic lawns, and I'm really glad you did because there is some residual chemicals that can stay in your compost, especially if a lawn was sprayed. Maybe to get rid of like nightshades or something like that. You may have trouble growing tomatoes in it, or sometime peas will suffer in it if that was what they were spraying for. But so Mary Eppelhoff, Worms Eat My Garbage, is a great book to start out with. It's a really incredible read, and she's very passionate about worms. And with the worms, I've done some experimenting with different kinds of compost bins, not with the worms themselves, but just with the methods of composting to determine like what works well. Vermicompost can be done, you know, in a large bin. You could do it in a bucket. You could just have an outdoor bin. Maybe not so much here. It does get a little chilly. But if you had someplace, a workshop or something that was a little frost protected, they will make it through the winter. Worms are just really fascinating, really with the resiliency and how they can make it through harsh climates. But they'll eat everything. And if you have chickens, you already know you're probably giving your scraps to the chickens. But there's some things that the chickens don't eat, like melon rinds and pumpkin rinds or squash rinds. And the worms absolutely love those kinds of things. So we have a couple different composting systems. We do like a forest compost where we have just a mesh wire, like old fencing. And we made a circle out of that. And we filled it with leaves in the fall. And then we've thrown in a little bit of produce scraps. We don't have any animal manure that we can put in there yet, but we've just been putting leaves and produce scraps in that. And then inside we have several, we've got into this year making vermicomposting furniture. And it's a lot of fun. People don't even know they're sitting on a bench filled with worms and compost in it. Another thing about worms, it's just a fun activity for kids and schools to get involved with. It's a great way for them to see actually what's happening in the soil levels It just really helps give you like an eye-to-eye level of what happens underground and how soil and humus and compost, how it all works together. Another good book, kind of on the biodynamic side, or this one's more of an intro to composting, is Earth, Plant, and Compost by William Breton. That's a really good one, and that goes over everything from doing large windrows to smaller backyard systems. So that's a good book if you're looking to get into just a little bit more about the overall different types of compost. And then there is biodynamic preparations, and these are done throughout the year, and at different phases of the year, different activities are done to prepare the compost. And it's absolutely amazing what happens with the biodynamic sprays and compost. A book I recommend for that is The Principles of Biodynamic Spray and Compost Preparations, and that's by Manfred Klett. And all three great books, absolutely outstanding. I'm very partial to the vermicomposting, so that is what I've been studying for the last many, many moons to help offer that. I do think we need to pay more attention to our soils, and by doing so, it always seemed a little ridiculous, too, to go out and buy soil in a bag and throw compost away. It just doesn't make sense. You can save a lot of money by composting, you know, reduce greenhouse gases.
40% of all vegetable scraps are composted. So you could throw them in the landfill, or you could start building soil for yourself.
That's excellent. And that reminds me of another point. If you want to learn more, there's several options out there. The U.S. Composting Council is also a good one to touch base with. And they estimate that everybody in America produces 4.5 pounds of compostable waste every single day. That is a huge amount. If you think, like, there's three in our family, and how much compost is that? I mean, that's like 13 and a half pounds of compostable waste that we're producing every day. I haven't actually measured ours in a long time, but we do compost all of it.
Also, back about 5 years ago, I was in Berkeley, and they have a city system of composting, which blew me away back then. Mm-hmm. But it is now starting to be talked about, and I do believe Asheville is seriously considering a citywide composting situation.
That would be amazing. The green waste that gets into landfills causes all kinds of situations besides the greenhouse gases. All that liquid being compressed can leach into soil, so they have to line landfills and do all kinds of different things. Or sometimes they have to pump the liquid goo away from landfills, and then they have that to dispose of. So that's really huge as well. And you'll find some things don't compost as well or take longer to break down. Corn cobs, they never seem to break down, but I still like to throw them in there. They will eventually break down. Some things just take longer than others. And we talked about leaves, but not all leaves are created equal. Some leaves you'll find out break more than others.
Yes, especially the oak leaves, which are so thick. If you want to use them for mulching, you really have to cut them some kind of scissor device.
From your compost, if you want to look with fertilizer, you can always make a compost tea, is putting some compost in a sock or an old tea bag, a muslin bag or something like that, or some kind of cotton sack, and putting it in a bucket of water and then letting it set overnight, or aerating it. And that reminds me, there are a couple of different kinds of compost. There's aerobic that has to do with oxygen, and that's when you're turning it. That's what worm compost is. And that just has oxygen. And then there's anaerobic compost, which some larger municipalities or even food distribution places are getting involved in. I think at one point, I don't know if it's still up and running, but Kroger Foods out of Cincinnati, Ohio, had a giant anaerobic digester that took in all their spent produce scraps or things that had gone bad, and they anaerobic without oxygen, they were able to break it down within, a week and sell that as compost.
Another area that that takes hard to break down is eggshells. Lots of people have problems with eggshells. Joe Hollis, Mountain Gardens, started me collecting eggshells. And for especially plants like ginseng that likes calcium, making a mush, crushing all of the cells and burying it someplace above your ginseng is actually a practice that we do on the farm.
Well, that's wonderful. We used to save our eggshells and then we would put them out on an oven tray and let them dry. And then we would, my coffee grinder does not grind coffee. we would put the eggshells in the coffee grinder and make a powder and then give that to the house plants or give that to the worms. Worms are kind of like chickens and alligators in a sense that they have a gizzard and they need that grit to break down their food. So if you do choose to get into worm composting, throw a handful of good garden soil or your eggshells in there. But eggshells, yeah, they do seem to really take a long time to break down. But that's great to know. The mush sounds a lot easier to make than drying and making a powder. I'll definitely try that next time. You just put them in a bucket and crush them? Or?
Yeah, I usually take a milk or a water bucket, 1 gallon, cut out the top. Just keep the handle and then just keep throwing the eggshells in until they get up. And then we have it as one of our intern joys to take and crush all the eggshells and then bury them.
Well, that's great. You can make whatever your... Just think about whatever your... You can either look at composting as being what your end goals are or what you have on hand. If your end goal is to have compost for your edible annual spring and summer gardens, then you know, composting with like worms, doing vermiculture, a compost that's more has more bacteria than fungal would be beneficial. So heavy on the produce scraps and things like that to compost. But if you want to compost for your fruit trees or for the forest, leaves and bark and the things that are like woodier and higher in carbon are going to be the things that you want to put in there. And it's absolutely amazing. We've had some plants that weren't doing well. And just over the last decade of giving them compost, I feel like it's how you were talking previously about healthy diet. By these plants having a healthy diet of compost, of continual compost supply, I stopped using any kind of liquid fertilizer on them and just gave them compost. And they were a lot of fruit trees planted real close together, and they're all doing a lot better now.
And now we're going to come to the close of this session on composting. And I want to give you some facts that are a little disturbing. The soil studies that have been done showing soil from 1950 and soil from 2014 shows a deficiency in all of our soils. This has led me to kind of really understand the concept of taking our nutrients and adding it to the compost, including urine, and also having humanure, composting toilets that, you know, the Native Americans, when the Europeans came and would poop or pee into perfectly good drinking water, they thought that that was, you know, absolutely the funniest thing going. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And so we really need to separate that out. And that's the last bit of information, other than if you want to get some forest compost in small amounts, go to a tree that's been down for numerous years, and at the base you'll start to see at the ground level of this dark, looks like coffee ground soil. That is the perfect compost to have. Okay. Let's, anything else on the composting, or you want to move on to rainwater harvesting?
Just a quick note on the urine. If you pee on your compost pile, it can heat it up extra, and it adds a lot of nitrogen to the compost. So something to consider. Thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to get into rainwater harvesting. And I was in California when I was introduced to Brad Lancaster, who comes out of
Tucson, Arizona,
and started just around his house and in his neighborhood using the roofs for harvesting rainwater. California was in a drought, and there was almost nobody had gutters, nobody had rain barrels, nobody was collecting water. They had Tea Party people telling me on the radio during this drought that millions of gallons of fresh water are put back into the Pacific every single day in California. It was appalling to me that the consciousness of letting all of this rain, when they get it, not be collected and harvested so that they can use it in their drought periods. So when Brad came along with his book, Rainwater Harvesting, it was just an eye-opener for a lot of people down there, and it started spreading really, really fast. And I cannot tell you how much I am now influenced by gray water, trying to have all of my water, extra water, go into gray water into the garden. And rainwater gardens, taking the excess of rain coming off of the roofs and making gardens from that at times during the year. And these, and having rain barrels now, we have five rain barrels at Eagle Feather. So I believe in it. They're the first place we go, the rain barrels, to water our plants. Plants seem to be really okay with the rainwater coming in. I cannot be hotter on this topic than to say, the reason that we have so much droughts are because of the bad policies that we have, specifically around rain, ponds and swells, that this is a place to recharge the subsoil and the water table. An excellent place to figure out where the water's running and how to collect it and take it down into the soil rather than run it off into our streams and storm sewers. the storm sewer system is eventually going to be looked upon like the dams where we're undamming our rivers and letting them flow wild again. So what we need to do is more protections when it does seem to flood into places that the water can go to settle out without being destructive. A good example of how the policies have created some of our havoc is the Barrier Islands that were down in New Orleans that would have stopped the Katrina from being a Hurricane 5 down to a Hurricane 3. But they got rid of them all so that the ships can go through easier. all of the dead zone outside New Orleans with all the nutrients in it that are floating down, because we're not protecting our lands. We're having too much runoff. We're having too much erosion. When we have erosion, we need to stop and start putting in mechanisms, maintenance, to correct those situations, whether it's rock, whether it's soil, whether it's sand, whatever it is. We need to design our places much better. The farm ponds that the United States government used to fund, agricultural farm ponds, don't exist anymore. And it's one of the reasons why our groundwater is, the table is going down and down. It's because we're not replenishing it at the source. We're taking it, we're putting it into our streams and rivers and taking that all the way down into our oceans and polluting our oceans. This is where we have to start, is on each and every piece of land. And those people who have natural springs on their lands should, in my estimation, be given courses on how to protect those springs and how to have a situation where we are looking at those as benefits rather than looking at the cost element of not doing it is tremendous. Another policy decision that I think is so ludicrous is all our power lines should be underground. If we had underground power lines, there wouldn't be any ice storms that are going to take down the power lines for days upon days. They'd all be underground. And we wouldn't have that extra radiation filtering into our air, because we lose 11% of our power through having overhead power lines. That's just another area where our policies are askew. Well, let's get back to rainwater harvesting, and I'm going to turn this over to Sina, who has been to some classes on this.
Thank you, Robert. That is a huge amount of power, 11%, and we do need to begin recharging our aquifers and looking at rainwater as a resource and not a waste, much like the composting was. Brad Lancaster was also an inspiration to me as well, living out in Phoenix. I got the pleasure of taking their class. It was about a 9-day course, I think, to be a water harvester, and that was through Watershed Management Group. If you're interested in learning more about water harvesting, Watershed Management Group, and then also Brad's website is harvestingrainwater.com. But his two books, Rainwater Harvesting for Dry Lands and Beyond, he's got volume 1 and 2, and I think he just came out with a third volume, and these books are great. They've translated them into several languages, and they are easy to read, they are informative, and it was actually a little surprising. There was a lot more math involved in rainwater harvesting than I had originally anticipated, but that's all right. That's not something you want to make a mistake on. One quick estimate, though, as you're looking at your property, if you think you want to do rainwater harvesting, you want to start at the top of your watershed, and that could either be the top of a hill nearby, or if you happen to be on flatland out here, your house would be the top of the watershed. And on a 1,000-square-foot roof on a 1-inch rain, you could harvest 600 gallons of water a day. And that rainwater doesn't have some of the contaminants that city water has or even some well waters. We're on a community well, and from my understanding, they have to put chlorine in a community well, and chlorine is very drying to the plants. So rainwater doesn't have the chlorine in it, and so it's better for the soil than water that's heavily chlorinated, or that water that may even have fluoride in it. But we had rain tanks, and it was absolutely amazing how quickly they would fill up just because the surface area was pretty large. And you can do tanks, the 55-gallon drums. You can order prefabricated tanks. You can make cisterns with block and concrete. Or you can use earthworks. And earthworks are creating berms and swales and places to move the water through your landscape. And when you're thinking about moving water through the landscape, you really want to slow spread it and sink the rainwater, and that helps minimize erosion. You don't want to move water too fast or too quickly from one place to another, because during the those channels are going to become eroded and you're going to eventually lose your swale. But you can do something as simple as berms. If you do berms and you do basins by your home, don't do them closer than 10 feet to your house. If you have a basement, you may want to move the earthworks out 20 feet just to ensure you don't have water coming in right close to the house. But rainwater is the best thing you can do for your plants, and it doesn't take a large surface area. It also amazes me that we poop and pee and are drinking water. It is when drinking water is something so special that... And we are running out of it as far as fresh water. And I think, was it less than 1% of the planet's fresh drinking water? I mean, it's a huge amount, and we need to pay a little bit more attention to that. Another great book, another guy also out of Tucson, Arizona, is Create an Oasis with Gray Water. It's a book by Art Ludwig. And it is absolutely amazing book for using gray water. He's got all different kinds of systems in there. There's all different kinds of things you can do with gray water. And some plants handle it differently than others. Like lawns would be a great example where you could use some gray water, you know, from your shower on. You know, fruit trees would like your kitchen sink water. Kitchen sink water is sometimes considered black water, like the toilet water is. But depending on what you're putting into your body will be depending on what we're going into your kitchen sink and your toilet as well to determine the compostability of it. But yeah, water reduction is huge. And if you can use gray water to flush your toilet as opposed to fresh water, then you're doing a lot better. We harvest our kitchen sink water, and we will use that to water our potted plants. And they've always thrived. We use earthworks now to move water. Oh, the laundry to landscape. Speaking of gray water, if you want to do one thing with your gray water to make a difference, your washing machine is the thing to put into your landscape. That outflow of water, especially if you have a septic system. A lot of us wear clothes with artificial fibers in them, and those do not break down. Those can form a thick mat in your septic system and inhibit the ability for water to penetrate and to leach out as quickly. So if you want to save the life of your septic system, you can move your washing machine water and have it go to fruit trees. It's excellent on fruit trees. You do have to pay attention to the detergents that you're using if you choose to go with gray water and the different soaps that you're using. But the washing machine is great. Depending on the model that you have, it can be anywhere from maybe 10, 20 gallons. If you have an older one, it can be 40 gallons of water a load. So that's a large amount of water that you can give to a newly planted fruit tree. Or maybe there's an area that doesn't get as much rainwater because there's a lot of trees overhead. Another thing with gray water is you never want to store gray water. Some people do store it like in a surge tank and then pull off of that. Your surge tank would just be a barrel that your gray water goes into first before going out into the landscape. I personally wouldn't recommend that. I've seen people do it successfully, but that's just another level. It's just another tank to clean out, and I'm not really interested in cleaning out tanks. But with rainwater, you can store that, and people do filter rainwater for drinking, especially in arid climates or rural areas where digging in a well might be very expensive. You may want to look into harvesting rainwater and putting filters in so that you can make it drinkable for that. But rainwater, you can store as long as you like. You can use it on everything from the lawn to your edible vegetables. You can use it to rinse your vegetables in. It's absolutely outstanding.
One thing that I do at my farm, because we're in the forest, is we do use dehumidifiers. Mm. And the water that comes out of the dehumidifier, I've been putting on the garden. On those plants that tend to be more acid loving, like my blueberries. And they seem to be okay with it. But it's just another area where you're collecting water, you're harvesting water. What are you going to do with it? You're going to put it into your septic. You're going to put it on some plants that might need it. Those, I think, are the new questions in the sustainability of water, so that when we go through droughts, we can go through it as easily as possible, that we're resilient to the drought.
That's really interesting about the dehumidifier. That reminded me about the AC unit. The water that comes off your AC unit, if you have a model like that, is considered distilled water. I wouldn't necessarily recommend drinking that, but the water from your AC unit being distilled, you could use that to water your plants, and it would be a very neutral water to use for irrigation. But yeah, growing up out west, was absolutely amazing to see the streets flood in the rains and then wonder why nobody harvested the water and actually sunk it into their own landscape. But check out Brad's website when you get a minute, Brad Lancaster, harvestingrainwater.com. I don't know if he's from Tucson or not, but their neighborhood, the Dunbar Springs neighborhood in Tucson, the before and after pictures is absolutely amazing. You think about a desert getting about 7 inches of rain a year, they were able to grow huge trees, and they completely transformed their neighborhood. It's more pleasant to walk through it all through. It's now a shady streets and shady sidewalks that you can walk through, and it's all watered from rainwater. Something else you might want to consider on the nicer days would be an outdoor shower. Again, shower water is great for the garden and great for the landscape. And if your shower is outdoor, it makes it a little bit easier to pipe it. If your house has a crawl space or a basement, you could look into replumbing the house to filter water outside. When designing your system, it would be really good to work with somebody experienced or an expert in the field, or get Brad Lancaster's book or the Art with Ludwig books and become the expert. You want to slow sink, and spread the flow of the rainwater, but you also want to be planning for overflow. You always want to have a system that is ready and designed for those 100-year flood moments. You don't want your earthworks blowing out in the wrong direction or your tank overflowing with no place for the water to go. I've seen tanks that were connected and stringed together, but the person had not planned for an overflow when the tank gets full. So what happened is the water was backing up into where the rain tanks were connected to the gutter system. And if you do have gutters on your house, you can put screens on them to keep leaf debris out and seeds out. What we also do on the downspout, we put in a rain head on our system. So this way, it's just an extra filter. It's basically just a box with a screen on it so that water can still go through the screen, but any leaf debris gets stuck on top and you can wipe that off after a rain and that the extra leaves and things don't end up in your tank. There's also another level of filtration you can do called a first flush. So the rainwater hits your roof, it goes into the gutters, into the downspout. Before it goes in the downspout to go to your rain barrels, it fills up this pipe. And then when that pipe is full, then it goes into your rain tank. So ideally, all the contaminants or dust and debris that might be on your roof during the beginning part of the rain are going to go into that first pipe and not into your tank system. So it just gives you a little bit cleaner, more clarity in the water that will be in your tanks.
Okay. Well, we're coming down the pike. Want to let everybody know that there is a class on ginseng and golden seal coming up April 15th. We would encourage anybody who would like to learn how to grow ginseng or golden seal to join the class. And we also would like to mention that the Organic Grower School will be happening in March And we will be there and have a table there, and we'll be able to answer questions personally. The other thing that we're thinking about is having people email us questions about plants or about our shows. And we're still working on getting a Gmail account for that. But that'll be coming down the line also. Last thoughts about composting or rainwater catchment?
Just a quick note on vermicomposting again. You really ought to get worms. Or just consider doing some kind of composting. Composting is very easy to do, and composting is very forgiving as well. If your compost is making an odor, it's definitely, you can add more soil or more dirt to it. But compost is very forgiving. It's a very easy thing to start, and all you need to do is start making a pile or get a bucket. You can also, what we've done with some of the things, we've just buried the produce scraps right in the ground, or the compostable materials right in the ground. And that is also a great way just to do that. We've even... It's a train coming by right now. I'll talk a little louder, but...
it's good that we're in the caboose.
Yeah. It's not too loud. The I make, you know, smoothies are good for people, and smoothies are also good for worms. So I have an extra blender at home. I'll throw produce scraps in and I'll blend it up, and the worms are able to eat it so much faster. It's absolutely amazing. But you know, many of you folks might be more interested in forest compost, and like Robert was mentioning, gorilla composting and picking up your neighbor's leaves is an outstanding way to increase the organic matter and the soil matter. And it's astounding how much of our soil that we lose every day just to wind and erosion. And there's some soils that become so dry that they actually repel water instead of absorb it, because they, or soils that have been real compacted will repel water and not absorb it, and then that can spread a lot of contaminants into our waterways. I've seen where they do curb cutouts, that kind of like public right-of-way between the sidewalk and the street, sometimes a grassy area with trees. I've seen them do curb cutouts. We did a workshop out west where we had someone come in and they made holes in the curb, and so that rainwater from the street would flow into this basin, and it would provide water and to the native trees and grasses that were in this basin area. And it was amazing. They were a little concerned about oil and different contaminants on the road, but the soil, the microbial soil life in that rain harvesting basin was absolutely astounding. And they weren't growing edibles. They were growing ornamentals, native plants that were for the foliage and for the pollinators. They showed no adverse effects. The soil microbes were breaking down the contaminants. It was absolutely astounding. It's just amazing what can be done with healthy soil. And then with the rainwater, just start. Just start and see how it goes. And check your systems during a rain. Get a good pair of rain boots if you don't already have them. And just go check your systems when it's happening. And accept the feedback. If you see, you know, you want to move water, or water is kind of sinking into another place, you can move it by constantly monitoring your system during rain events. You'll be able to get feedback right away, and also by watching your plants and how they're doing. The health of your plant will also determine how effective the rainwater systems are. But just try it out.
Well, here we are, very close to the end of our fourth show, and we appreciate anybody who's listening, and would love to see how much time we have. Oh, we got a whole 10 minutes to go. Okay. Well, we should branch out into some kind of a rant on something that's significant. I would like to start it out by talking about EMFs, electric magnetic frequencies, and the smart meters that are on your home, and how bad that is that you shouldn't be sleeping close to that smart meter at home. Also, the look at the phone instructions that they give you that you sign on to, and they'll say in small print that you're not supposed to put the phone closer than an inch and a half to your head. So use your speaker. But there's all kinds of electric magnetic frequencies that are out there, and they're getting more prevalent. All of the cell towers produce these. We need to really look at this in a way that has us hoping that the legislation can put some skids on some of these things. For instance, the the smart meter, the power company with the computers and everything, could turn on the meter when they want to read it and not have it on all the time. Technologically, that's possible. It's going to cost them more money. But this is something I think that we all need to be aware of. These electric magnetic frequencies, EMFs, are not good for us, nor are they good for the plants. They don't seem to, I don't feel benefit from any of this electric magnetic frequencies activity that is increasing all around us. Any thoughts?
I completely agree. It's amazing what we expose ourselves to today, and I'm a big fan of Wi-Fi, but there are studies coming out with Wi-Fi as well, where you can actually, it's affecting people, and there's so much that happens on a minute level that we are just beginning to figure out. It's like the research is almost just is trying to catch up to our actions and catch up to technology. But I think it's important to, you know, to look at, if you're when using a smartphone, like Robert was saying, to keep it far away from your or inch and a half, or use the speaker, so not have it so close. It's also not good to have it in your pocket all the time. The radiation emitting from it can have an effect on it, on bodily systems as well.
Yeah, this is definitely an area that we're going to need to stand together on, because the industry is not going to want to police itself. So, you know, they're going to want to put smart meters everywhere, so that the Wi-Fi can happen all over the place. And we really have to think about this really strongly, whether this is something that's desirable for our community. There is a whole lot of beginning research that is showing that you can, if you bombard animals with enough of these, that you can cause cancer. It also stresses them out. So we have enough stuff in our environment that stress us out. We don't need to have another layer on top of it. One of the things that is an excellent sign that your EMF level is too high is that you have trouble sleeping. It interferes with your sleeping patterns. And that is really not good if you want to be productive the next day. And so I want people to start thinking about some of the things that just everybody takes for granted is being done for, in the name of progress, that really is maybe making some people wealthy, but is not necessarily good for the health of the country.
Yeah, that is true. Not everything that is has to do with wealth is going to be in our best interest, and we have to do that with keeping in contact with our legislations and being aware of the things that are happening.
Okay, so we're going to close this session out. Again, thank you so much for listening to Plants and Their Friends on WART 95.5 FM. And we're here at the Caboose on Main Street in Madison, in Marshall, Madison County. And
thank you so much.